Welcome to the Artistic Foodies, the show that explores life through the lens of art and food. I'm Abbas Muhammad.
And I'm Irfan Raidan.
And today we're talking with Rabia Chaudhry about her memoir, Fatty Fatty Boom Boom. We talk about Ramadan foods, recipes, including her top secret family recipe for shami kebabs, and her lifelong journey and struggles with weight. So be sure you listen all the way through.
Rabia Chaudhry is an attorney, advocate, and author of the New York Times best-selling book, Adnan's Story, and her critically acclaimed second book, Fatty Fatty Boom Boom, a memoir of food, fat, and family. Rabia is the executive producer of the HBO documentary series, The Case Against Adnan Syed, and also co-producer and host of the podcast, Undisclosed, Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case, Nighty Night, The Hidden Jinn, and The 45th.
Okay, cool. So I wanted to ask if you would be interested in reading some, maybe a couple pages, some of your favorite stories or maybe some of my favorite stories. and that'll be a nice little intro into the episode for folks that maybe haven't read the book yet.
Yeah, I saw that, and I you tell me what you want me
okay,
to read.
Okay, so you can pick. My two favorite ones are the story about being Pervez Musharraf's niece or smuggling Tupperwares of food out of the chest. Because I've definitely seen Ziploc bags in purses when I've gone to a buffet. Okay, so that was a very relatable experience.
So this is a story about how the last time I was in Pakistan with my grandmother, which was quite a while ago, about 18 years ago or so, we went out to one final big meal. My maternal uncles wanted to take my grandmother and me out to one big meal at this very popular Chinese restaurant before I headed back home to America. So this is the story of how that went down. And that evening, my mamu handed my grandmother like the biggest purse she owned. And she's like, I don't want to take this. And he's like, no, just take this. So, all right. We arrived 30 minutes later at a beautifully appointed, proper sit-down Chinese restaurant, again, in Goldberg. The staff and chef were all Chinese, some of the many tens of thousands of Chinese nationals who settled in Pakistan, thanks to our shared border, robust trade, and the many infrastructure projects that China was funding and overseeing in Pakistan. We settled around a cloth-covered round table, waiters in brocade vests hovering around us, taking our drink orders, but there was no menu. That was because this restaurant only offered a lavish 25-dish buffet, four kinds of soup, egg rolls, dumplings, scallion pancakes, a dozen Sichuan and Cantonese entrees, stir-fried noodles and rices, and a variety of desserts. Pace yourself, said Bummy Mamu. It's going to be a long night. At 300 rupees per person, I knew he took the mission of getting his money's worth seriously. We brought Nani Amma, my grandmother, a bowl of soup and appetizers and made her an entree plate and then got down to business ourselves. Fill up your plate as much as possible, hissed Hangul Mamu. No, why? I can get seconds, I pointed out. Just do it, especially the stir-fried prawn and chicken lollipops. Get extra. I did as told, piling up the prawn and six chicken lollipops, leg pieces in which the meat has been scraped up and stuffed with the filling, then battered and fried so they look like a lollipop. A waiter standing behind the buffet raised his eyebrows at me, and I returned to my seat quickly, embarrassed. No way was I going to eat all those chicken legs, but maybe my uncle wanted me to get them to share with the others. I looked around the table, and they both had their plates piled high too. Bummy Mamu leaned over and whispered to Nani Amma. She shook her head. Then he whispered again, urgently. She was sitting on my left, and she leaned down into her purse on the ground between us and pulled out a Tupperware container and slipped it under her shawl. Oh my God, this was not happening. My face was burning up. They were going to get me arrested for stealing food from a buffet, and I'd never get another visa to Pakistan. All for a few hundred rupees. No, Nani Amma, don't do it. I'll pay for dinner, I softly begged. But there was no going back. Slowly, ever so casually, my uncle spent the next 15 minutes transferring prawn and chicken from their plates onto hers, which she would then slip into the container in her lap and put in her purse. Then they reached over to take the food I wasn't eating off my plate and popped it onto hers too. They tag-teamed the effort, watching the waiters, who watched the patrons like hawks. Or at least it felt like they were looking right into our souls, circling us like wardens, but that was probably me projecting my guilt. Every half hour or so, my uncles would fill up the plates, eat some of the food, and disappear the rest until four containers were packed away in Nani Amma's purse. Over 2 hours passed, exacting this malfeasance. I was convinced we would all be stopped on the way out and imagined my tiny little grandmother humiliated and handcuffed just so my uncles could satisfy their gluttony. We paid the bill and left without incident, my uncles strutting out as if they had conducted the greatest heist of the 20th century, me and my nanny quietly enraged. "I will never go to a buffet with you again," she said the minute we got in the car. The uncles laughed, and then Bummy Mamu twisted around in his seat and looked at me. "This is about justice. It's completely unjust for them to charge that much, and we only eat a plate and leave. That's criminal. This evens the score. You'll be a lawyer soon. You should care about justice." All I cared about then was getting out of there. I turned away angry. A few hours later, though, I joined my uncles on the veranda around midnight, they in their undershirts and pajama bottoms, me in my long cotton nightgown. Together, we sucked the sauce off big fat prawns and chewed on chicken lollipops until they were all gone.
It's hilarious. Good stuff.
Good times. Yeah, my poor grandmother.
Your mamas are hilarious. I'm just imagining your nanny like walking out in handcuffs from a Chinese buffet place like, these kids.
The humiliation of like a waiter grabbing her purse and putting the Tupperware. I couldn't believe what was happening. And I was like, I can pay for this. I got this. But no,
it's about justice. It's about the principle.
My mamas are insane. I have five crazy uncles.
That's hilarious. And this is one of many funny stories. The other story where when you're in the market and they're slapping around the shopkeepers saying, "This is Pervez Musharraf's niece. What are you doing?" That one cracked me up too.
And like the cheapest market in Lahore. I'm like, why would Pervez Musharraf's niece be shopping at this thrift market?
It's hilarious.
Surreal.
And I love that you chose food as a medium for storytelling, because really that's something that everyone can relate to. You were reading that, I mean, at the time of recording this, it's Ramadan. I don't know about you guys, but I'm fasting and all I can think about is prawns and chicken lollipops right now.
Yeah.
I'm on the side. Let me Google where I'm doing iftar. Where is the chicken lollipops?
I only ever had them in Pakistan. I don't know if it's a thing here. I don't know if you can get them here.
There's some places that have those, yeah.
Yeah.
But I have to admit to you that I was very surprised that I could relate to so much in your book, because you know when you look at the main theme and the title and everything, you assume that it's going to be mostly about women and you know weight issues and.
Yeah.
That stuff. But, you know, for example, my family, my father is from Karachi, and Maimon family.
Okay.
But I'm married to a Punjabi lady. So there's a lot of stuff in there which I could definitely relate to. And especially about in the beginning when you're describing about the, you know,
the differences.
Your mother came and she was very looking down at the villagers, you know, that kind of
the Punjabis. Yeah. The funny thing is, like, we didn't even, there was no village. My dad didn't come from a village. they were city people from Lahore. We don't even have a village. But my mom, in my mom's sensibility, being from, you know, this Delhi, this, you know, elite city, she's like, oh, Punjabis are all like these rural agricultural, you know, whatevers. But yeah, no. I'm half Punjabi, but really I'm pretty much full Punjabi.
That's what my wife says about my kids. Like she says they're Punjabi. They're not.
The blood is too strong. You can't hide it.
Very strong. But I have to say, ethnically by blood, I'm Punjabi. But like at this point, Urdu and Punjabi feel like foreign tongue. When I go to Pakistan, I feel like a foreigner. I feel out of place.
Oh. But
you put me in front of a buffet, I'm at home. Like, I'm like fully Punjabi. Like, let's go with it. You know? Like, you on my garlic naan? Because we ain't messing around.
As long as you eat like a Punjabi, you're good.
So you just did a big book tour, a lot of stops. And I mean, you're no stranger to the touring life. You've done a lot of speaking tours and the HBO series. And so you've done a lot of sort of this work in the public eye, but this time it was for something completely different. So how did that feel to present to the world now as an author and doing this is like, this is, you know, this is my own labor of love. compared to everything, all the other work that you've done in the public eye?
You know, when after Adnan's, the first book, Adnan's Story, became, you know, bestseller, and it, you know, it was doing really well, and it got a lot of critical success too. My publisher and lit agent were like, what are you writing next? I mean, like, I couldn't even think about what am I writing? Like, I was still in the depths of trying to exonerate, like, you know, in the case. But, you know, I said, I need some time. And I took my time. I mean, it's been 6 years since the last book came out. But about 3 years in, I said, okay, you know, what can I, Adnan's Story took so much research because it's heavily documents the investigation. I had to go through thousands of case documents to make sure I got every fact right, the dates right, all the forensics right, you know. So I was like, what can I write that I don't have to do a ton of research on? I was like, oh, a memoir. Like, that's all in my, that's my story. But then it's like, what kind of memoir do I want to write? So much of my career work has, like you said, been in the public eye. Like, people kind of know, right? Like, a lot of my work has been in the Muslim community. And then it's, and I was like, I'm kind of tired of telling that story. I also didn't want to do the being in America, or being a Muslim in America post 9/11. I feel like I've talked about it and talked about it, and we've lived it. And what's the story that I have never shared before? And that is the short story of, like, at being, you know, in my 40s and having a lifelong struggle with weight. And I realize every time I get together with my friends, the only things we ever talk about is how to lose weight and what are we going to eat next. That's all we ever talk about. And I'm like, this is not, it's not just going to be my story. This is going to be a story that, like, I know every woman can relate to, but I'm glad to hear, Irfan, that you related to it too. And I just thought it would also, but with my weight, I don't call it a weight loss story. It's just like my weight story, you know, the story of my weight struggles and coming to the point of finally understanding my body and befriending my body and, figuring out what it actually responds to. But there's no way to divorce that from all the food stories because my parents were like, we want you to lose weight, but you also have to eat everything that's on your plate. You got, you know, eat well, eat, you know, eat, eat. And they never were able to, like, separate these things. And so I said, this all has to kind of go together, like the food stories and the weight story. And it's been incredible to be able to tour. Like, I'm in the Midwest and these Midwestern white ladies are like, we have nothing in common, but this is my story. All of it resonates with me. Like, it's felt so good to do that. Yeah.
That's really amazing.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, so I was just listening to the audiobook. So I didn't actually read it, but I listened to the audiobook.
That's reading. Sure.
And, yeah, that's my new reading because my commute and stuff very convenient. But I also, I mean, I like audiobooks because you get to, especially for these kind of stories, you know, from our background, I also listened to Wajahat's memoir too. And, you know, it's a lot different because you get to hear the actual person and, you know, all the funny, you know, the way that you guys say certain things, like the Chinese story that you just, Chinese restaurant story that you just did. Yeah. So it's hilarious, but, I could relate to a lot of stuff because, I, you know, I went to Pakistan in 2012 before me and my wife had kids. But my wife's family, they had a house in Lahore in defense. We stayed there for like a month. But then we also, they also had, at that time, they had, you know, a village, they had farmland, right? So you went there for a couple of days. So a lot of the stuff you're talking about, like the buffalo milk, and all that stuff, is like I could relate to it because I actually had it. And it definitely is better. Chai with buffalo milk is definitely a lot better than regular.
You see those little globs of oil floating on top of the chai. You're like, why is there oil on top of my chai? But it's the buffalo milk is so fatty.
Yeah,
it's and so I literally like was raised on buffalo milk and butter for the first 2 years of my life.
I'm missing out.
Yeah, so I could.
Yeah,
definitely.
You can taste the buffalo in it.
Buffalo enjoys it. But one thing, just really quick about Punjabi food. It's like my wife and her mom, they're really into saag. Right.
Oh yeah.
And just like almost every Punjabi family is, but I consider myself a foodie. You know, I like to eat all kinds of different food.
Oh no, but you're gonna diss the saag.
Yes.
Are you gonna diss the saag?
I'm going on a record here, official record here. Saag is no good. It tastes like dirt. My wife doesn't listen to this, so she's not
grounds
gonna know.
For divorce. Listen,
has left the chat.
But what they do is they put big chunks of butter in there and they try to make it taste good, but it's like you're tasting grass and dirt. It's like,
do you not do you like greens at all? Do you eat spinach? It's supposed to be earthy.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my god, I love. Okay, so you're not into greens at all. So that's not Irfan problem. That's a youth problem.
Yeah. So now I have to.
Well, white people love
sog.
Sog
is too much like a salad. I don't want to.
Yeah. It's like a cooked salad. Yeah.
I love sog, and I don't make it because it takes time to make, especially if you make it properly with the mustard greens. You know, they're like bitter and tough, and you got to break them down. And then the makai ki roti, of course, if you have it like that, then. But listen, it's like, you know, in the American South, you got greens and cornbread. It's literally the Punjabi version of greens and cornbread.
Yeah.
And so these things are meant to be together. These like greens and corn.
I never. Thank you for drawing that line. Yeah, makai ki roti and cornbread. Wow.
It's literally made with the same ingredients. We're just making it differently. One's on a tava, you're making it flat. The other one, you're baking.
That's amazing. You have your fried chicken and your chicken charga. I mean, you could draw these lines all day. That's amazing.
Well, you know, there's some foods that just go together, and that's the greens, cooked greens, and a corn, some kind of a cornbread accompanying, like just kind of goes together.
One thing that reminds me of actual, when I went to Lahore, I was, you know, I'm a typical American born, Desi confused. I don't, you know, speak, Urdu anything.
You don't at all?
I can understand a little bit, but okay. No, I'm a ABCD, as they say. Yeah. But, when I went to Lahore, we had a driver, you know, he understood a little bit and I understood a little bit. So he were able to take us around different places. But
I'm so glad you didn't get kidnapped.
Oh yeah, that would have been bad. But we went to Gulberg, as you had mentioned, where all the nice restaurants are. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Abbas has ever been there before, but you definitely gotta go there. That's like a foodie heaven there. But
that's great, and the boutiques are great. Yeah,
yeah. But we went to a nice steak restaurant. I forgot the name of it now in Gulberg, and then. Me and my wife, we had two steaks. I had filet mignon. She had another steak. We had appetizers. We had drinks. Everything was like 3,000 rupees, which for us was like $30 US, right?
Yeah. And then it's even less now.
It's probably 300 like what?
Rupees to a dollar. That's like, $3. Oh, wow. Yeah, it's insane.
That's crazy. Yeah, so I was just going to say that was like amazing food, great, you know, great service, of course, and very inexpensive. And then, but my wife made the mistake of, you know, she just told the driver when we got home, or when we got back to the car, she's, oh yeah, we just spent 3,000 rupees. And he's like, what?
Oh,
like for them, it was like,
that's,
you know,
his month's salary. Yeah. So, oh no, Americans live, when we go with dollars, we live like kings over there.
Yeah.
But I have to giggle at going to Pakistan. This is like, I mean, if you're going to go to Pakistan, why are you going to eat the steak and sushi in Pakistan, man? Come back to America for that. You got to eat the kadhai.
Of course, you eat that too. But you can't, for $30, two steaks, like filet mignon, you can't skip that.
See, I had very different sort of foodie experience in Pakistan. I mean, like, I was like, okay, I'm only in, I flew all the way around half of the globe to be here. I'm going to try Pakistani food. Let me see what Pakistanis are eating. I need to be in touch with my roots. So first day, we go out to some karai daba and we eat some karai. And it was probably the best karai that I had ever had. And this was day one of my 2-week trip. For the next 10 days, I couldn't keep anything down. I was completely.
I was going to say, did you get sick immediately?
Yeah. And I was there for my wedding. So it's the day of my wedding. My face is completely pale. People are like, wow, you look so fair. You look great. I'm like, well, I have no blood in my face. And
completely dehydrated.
But the dinner menu, that was fantastic. Everything tasted amazing. Yeah.
You just gotta know. Listen, I have about 7-8 years ago, I took both my daughters, before I had my son, I took both my daughters to Pakistan for an entire month. We ate everywhere, but you have to know what, and we never got sick because you have to know. It's just the water. But if you eat fresh, like it, salads will get you, chutneys will get you because the vegetables are washed with the tap water. You just have to know. So as long as you know what not to eat, it wasn't the kadhai that got you because that's cooked. It was probably some like sliced onions on the side or something.
Wow, that is so
like
sneaky. Some, that is so sneaky. Yeah.
That's what it is. You cannot eat the fresh.
In your book, you're talking about like this guy who's making kebabs and mixing it with his feet. So I don't know.
Okay, that's true.
I don't know.
My uncle did say it passes through the flame and it's purified. They were delicious, Abbas. Look, don't judge.
Crispy hair and all. I mean.
Texture, yeah.
You know, I'm planning on going to Pakistan sometime in the next year or so. So my plan this time is to just book 4 weeks, plan to be sick for the first two, and then eat everything in the last two.
No, you got it. You can do it without getting sick at all. Honestly, I swear you can do it. You just got to know not to have anything that touches the tap water. And by the way, I'm working with a tour company in Pakistan to, we're going to have an annual tour that I'll be part of to to get Americans to go to Pakistan.
Nice.
And it'll be like a 10-day tour from Lahore to Sindh. It's going to be amazing. Oh, so wow. Of course, I was like, I bet you a lot of Pakistani Americans will want to come too, because like folks like us don't get to see Pakistan in that way. We'll have security, we'll have luxury buses. And so okay, keep
well,
an eye out for that.
When's your first cohort? Literally, I want one of those seats. I'm going to book my trip around that.
It's going to be limited.
Rabia's food tour of Pakistan.
We're gonna spend like 4 days in Lahore, and then we're gonna go down. No, it's not gonna be just food. It'll be like historic sites, Mohenjo-daro, Sindh, Sufi sites. It'll be things that Rabia likes, basically.
I'm here for all of that. Yeah. I want to see the Sufi sites. I want to get goofy at the restaurants and get it all.
It'll be in January, the first couple weeks of January is what we're aiming for. But we're gonna start like it'll be 30 people, very limited. And we're going to start advertising probably late summer.
Cool. January is a good time. Summers are very oppressive there.
Yeah. If we did a summer tour, which I might do in the future, we would go up north, like Gilgit. Yeah. But right now we're going to do a winter tour.
Okay. Yeah. This is going to be my attempt to my reattempt to being Pakistani. My life has just been this lifelong quest of trying to get back.
Claim your heritage. Claim your heritage. This land is
I
our
do
land.
That by just, wearing just kurtas don't. When I go out. Kurta jeans. I'm like, look at me. I'm Pakistani. Oh, man.
Just don't drink the water.
Don't drink the water. You heard it here, folks. Don't drink the water.
Don't drink the water in Pakistan.
Or Philadelphia, apparently. I just heard that Philadelphia people can't drink public tap water anymore. Like, listen, the people got water problems all over the world. So
That's true.
So, okay, so water is definitely a crucial ingredient in almost all of our cooking. It is something that is in every dish, of course. What out of every ingredient is an ingredient that you would choose? Something that you put in all of your dishes, something that is maybe your favorite ingredient, and why?
My favorite spice to use is cumin. I will make lasagna and it's going to have cumin in it. If I make spaghetti, if I make fried chicken, it'll have some cumin in the batter. I love cumin. And it's one of the most quintessential South Asian spices. Like how can you make, at least from not in South India maybe, but in Punjabi cooking, there's nothing you can make without zeera. You just can't. That's a flavor profile you have to, and it's one of my favorite. I love cumin seeds. I love them roasted. I love black cumin, white cumin. It's my answer is cumin.
And you came ready with it too. That's 100% certainty. Cumin. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. I think that's one way to desify any dish. It's okay, this is cool, but does it have cumin in it? And then you taste it and all of a sudden it's why does this taste desi?
And then you sprinkle a little bit of cilantro, haradhania on top, and you're done. It's a pasta.
Okay, I'm trying not to get completely hungry here.
And now a word from our sponsors. Penny Appeal USA is a Muslim nonprofit charity that specializes in sustainable relief. They have been working in 30-some countries, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, Palestine, and lately for the earthquake efforts in Syria and Turkey as well. Penny Appeal USA has several programs to help people from all around the globe, including here in the US. They provide countries with the necessary tools to support themselves for future generations. As a prophet, peace be upon him, once said, "The charity you give will be your shade on the day of judgment." Shade yourself with the tree of giving by visiting pausa.org to learn more and make a donation.
Quickly, just back to the book tour. I'm wondering if there is anything that you want to share with folks that you maybe didn't get an opportunity to share as much during the book tour, or if there's something about the book, about what you want people to know about the book. Imagining that some folks that are listening to this episode haven't read the book yet. Of course, they're going to want to read it after hearing all these funny stories.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, if you're, it's interesting, you know, every stop on the book tour was kind of different depending on, like, you know, what the moderator wanted to talk about. Like right now, we're talking most about the food. We haven't talked about the weight at all, you know, and so much of the book is the central theme of the book for me as a writer is the weight story, and then how food figures into that weight story, and family figures into that weight story, and everything else in my life figures into that weight story. And so if there's something, and listen, I know this is a struggle so many people have. There's not a single person I know in my life who is like satisfied with their body. not the tiniest friend I have. And, you know, everybody's always trying to make changes in their body. And having like, I just think that for folks who have gone through this similar struggle where like there's no diet they haven't tried, there's like desperation, there's like a moral judgment about them, because we are morally judged for when you have a weight problem. I put that in quotes, as the world sees it or our culture sees it. It's judged like a moral failure. Like, you just don't have the discipline. All you got to do is stop eating. It's just calories in and calories. And basically it's all a load of BS. We have been fed lies for decades about how food works, how our metabolism works, why people gain weight, what is in the food supply in America that makes us so sick and heavy and addicted. And I just always think, God, I wish I knew what I know now, I wish I knew 20 years ago, so I didn't hate myself so much, you know? So for people who have had that kind of struggle, body image, you know, this is not a book, it's a lighthearted book. It's not a book that's gonna make you feel terrible. And it's not a woe is me book. But I feel like you're gonna come along for the journey. And by the end of it, I hope you feel some sense of resolution the way it took me 45 years. Too. There's a woman who wrote to me, and I've gotten so many messages about the book, but this is one of the ones that really sticks out, because I write about the Presidential Fitness Challenge, which I failed miserably back in fifth grade, and how, you know, that was, I was publicly weighed. We all got publicly weighed. And I remember how much I weigh at every point in my life, because those memories are seared into my brain. And, you know, I just had so much shame about like this failure. I couldn't do any part of the fitness test and pass it. And this woman wrote to me and said, you know, I have been carrying the shame of the Presidential Fitness Test since like seventh grade. Wow. And after finishing your book, the shame has finally ended for me.
Oh, wow.
That's great. You know what I mean? It's crazy, the things that we carry for just no reason.
Seventh grade. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was since fifth grade, you know, and my sister, who was 2 years younger than me, she passed because she's always been lanky and thin and athletic. And Ronald, the certificates they would give you, because the presidential was like a photocopy of like Ronald Reagan's signature back. This is the '80s, right?
Yeah.
My parents were like, Sidra got a certificate from Ronald Reagan. The president of the United States recognized our third grader. And I'm like, this is all a big scam.
Wow. Yeah, I got that same certificate too. But another thing, which first of all, I want to applaud you for writing all these personal stories, especially about weight, because I know it's a very difficult topic, especially for Desi women. But a lot of the stuff, even, you know, as a man myself, I could relate to a lot of the stuff. Going to school, I was the only, you know, brown Muslim kid in school, so I could relate to a lot of the stuff. But now when I'm older, I'm almost 50 years old now, so I'm having these health issues. And
I'm almost there. I'm 49 this year, Irfan. I'm with you.
I was growing up, I just ate whatever I wanted to. And you're right, we don't realize all the stuff in America and even Canada, the stuff that they put into the food.
Poison.
And this is what like our parents and grandparents used to make fun of the food in to America, right? They used to say it's poisonous, but we didn't believe it because we thought, oh, you know, what do they know? They're just, you know, used to just eating the.
Well, you know, my parents actually were completely opposite. They always thought that the food back home, they say, meaning that it's always mixed. It's never pure. Like you can't trust it. There's no regulation. My parents always thought the food in America is like regulated. It's good for you. Yeah. The American government is not gonna let Americans eat terrible, you know, what's not healthy for you. They thought everything is healthy and clean.
Government loves us, right? So,
yeah, I mean, and when my parents wanted kids in a candy store when they came from Pakistan, suddenly in the 70s, they're like, oh my God, aisles and aisles of breads and crackers and cookies. And it's cheap, you know, it's convenient. They love fast food. Both my parents are fatties, you know, they love fast food. And so that was my palate. I ate like that because my parents were eating like that when I was a child. They were eating absolute crap.
Yeah, that's true. And then there was, I think a recent study recently came out that in the 70s that, you know, the sugar, big sugar or whatever they call it, was pushing the FDA to make it look like that. No, it's not sugar's fault that all these health issues are happening. It's fat.
It was fat, right? We all started eating fake butter.
Yeah, fake butter out of, like, and all this
plastic
stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's all lies. It's all, there's a reason people in this country have so many food allergies, but they can travel to other countries and they're fine. Suddenly they can eat the gluten and the dairy and they don't have the same, like, you know, reaction to it. Like, there's just so much crap in our food supply.
Yeah. And I think, like, the cards are really stacked against us. I was looking at a couple different studies. This came out of some articles about epigenetics. And there are two things that struck out to me. One of them is that during the few hundred years that the British were ruling over our lands, there were a number, I want to say 3 or 4 dozen manufactured famines. And so our ancestors over the years, the ones who survived are the ones who survived the famines, meaning the ones who could make the most out of very little nourishment. So these are the body types that got passed on. These are the organs, the epigenetics of the organs that got passed on. And so now within one generation, you go from, you know, from that kind of a lifestyle to an abundance, to an overabundance, and your body just doesn't know what to do with it because it's used to for so many generations making a lot out of a little. Now you have a lot, and it's like, okay, well, we're gonna store this because we don't know when the next famine is. But there's no next famine because Walmart's 4 minutes away.
You know? Right. I mean, thank God there's no famine, but also, you know, we're just dying from food-related diseases.
Right, exactly. That's completely the other side. And our bodies are not used to it. Evolution takes a long time, right? And then the second thing that struck out to me, and this is really interesting, I was studying the epigenetics of Punjabi people after I did my DNA testing. I was like, ooh, let's see, what are we up to? What's in our genes? And there's a high amount of alcoholism and addiction that are actually linked to certain genes that make Punjabis have a predisposition for addiction. And I saw this as a possible, like, well, okay, do I have an addictive personality because of that? Because when it comes to, you know, Islam is here to, you know, to tell us don't drink, don't do drugs. If you don't go into those pleasures, you know, what pleasure do you have in front of you? Right. And in America, it's intentionally addictive. So you combine that with your predisposition. And I was just like, wow, like I have felt really bad for so long. People have made me feel bad, but this is literally in my blood.
No, it's in your blood, but also you're right. It's designed to keep us addicted. Like, you know, I mean, that's why, like, I want people to stop judging themselves and stop feeling like failures for, like, being unable to stop eating XYZ because it's designed like that. It's been chemically designed to actually keep you addicted, like you're having cocaine. The sugar is cocaine. Now, listen, I'm not that person. I don't want people to think I've cut sugar out of my life. Like, I need an emotional support payday bar, like, every couple of days. I need a whole candy bar. Okay. I'm not that person. I because I realized in order to live your entire life, any kind of diet that eliminates things, like, it's not sustainable. You have to be able to live in the world, right? And like you said, I'm not snorting cocaine or drinking wine every night. What pleasure do I have? It's a payday bar. Like, that's all I got as a Muslim. So, but it's about just not letting it overtake my life, right? Like, and which it has, there have been, and I write about this in the book, times when I'm out of control eating and I don't know what it feels like to feel full. Like, for years, I did not know. For most of my life, I did not know what it feels like to feel full. And this fantastic article came out just a couple of days ago, which is probably one of the best articles I've read about obesity. And it's around the new Ozempic drug that's like kind of the rage now for people to lose like tons of weight. It's a diabetes drug that people are using to lose weight. And they talk about how, and this is the first time I saw a scientific explanation, that, you know, as your body has like stores more fat and stuff, it messes up your hormones in different ways, right? It affects your hormones. And those hormones, then something happens where there's, you stop producing or you overproduce the hormone that actually tells you you're full. And it's not there. That signal is gone. Cause I used to be like, is there something wrong with my body that like my friend can eat and feel full, but I don't know what it feels like to feel full. And now I have a scientific explanation for that. But yeah, but society is like, no, it's just because you're a glutton and you don't know when to stop and you have no self-control. Yeah. And it's, no,
it's
not
all about that leptin, right? And that's because that's a hormone that you're talking about that your stomach produces to tell your brain, okay, we're full. Now here's the funniest thing. Leptin takes about 20 minutes to get to your brain. So your stomach is full. 20 minutes later, your brain's like, oh, I'm full. So, you know, that's why they say you should eat slow. You should take a lot of bites and, you know, give your body a chance. But the way I see it is like, I have 20 minutes to eat as much as possible before my brain finds out that we're done. Especially around iftari time. I'm like, set the timer. Let's go.
It's a whole time. Well,
that's why by the time your brain finds out, you're in a food coma because you have eaten way more than you were supposed to. You know, this whole thing about like, you know, and my grandfather, you know, I remember when I was a kid, he said, chew every morsel 25. I mean, there's a lot of wisdom in our ancestral food traditions. Yeah. And, you know, even the things we put from the turmeric to the ginger, like I really believe in home cooking. I believe in, you know, and my editor was very resistant. She was, you know, a middle-aged white lady who didn't know a lot about food, never had a weight problem. She's like, why are you putting these recipes in? You know, the recipe calls for like oil and this. I'm like, yeah, but it's not unhealthy. It's not unhealthy. Every single thing is a whole food in there. It's all stuff in my kitchen. I know what these ingredients are and you eat them, you know, in proportion to your, what you want to eat. And so this idea that our native food, our foods are good foods are, you know, I do think though, you know, now I know the same Western food related diseases are spreading in Pakistan, India, and the rest of the developing world. And I think that's because there's McDonald's on every corner. Like it's the same thing is happening over there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's definitely true about, cause you know, when you used to talk to non-Muslims about Ramadan and stuff, you know, we talk about the benefits of fasting and all that. And we say that because, you know, it's part of our religion to not to control how much we eat, right? That there's a hadith of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam to eat one third food, one third water, and have space one third for air. Yeah. But the point is now, even in the Muslim world, like Dubai and everywhere, like you said, people are gaining weight because they're eating all the fast food and junk food. And now even in Pakistan, in the farmland, now they're putting same kind of pesticides that they do in America. So it's like the same things are starting to happen over there. So it's like, it's very dangerous, you know, very dangerous situation.
Cook at home, people. Cook at home. Learn. It's not brain surgery. Mm-hmm. Everybody can do it.
And I'm really glad that you put your recipes into the book because your stories are very tantalizing. I'm like, oh, I want to know what that tastes like. And it's like, okay, but I've had this dish, but I wonder what how her family cooks it. And like, you know, because it's always every cook has a different.
Oh yeah. Every family's got their own version.
And so I'm you know, including your recipes, you have ghee, you have classic onion pakore, you have parathe, lahori fried fish, dal, seekh kebab, sarso da saag, which is Irfan's favorite, chicken salan, chicken yakhni palau, shahi tukre, and chai. So I hope the listeners who are fasting listening to this Like, get that book and get the rest.
I still got like 7 hours, man.
Are there any dishes that are not in the book that maybe you'd like to share as a little treat to our listeners?
You mean share the actual recipe right now?
I mean, like, you know, in like a very like desi way, put a little bit of this, put a little bit of that, but like, you know, take us on a journey with something you've been cooking lately.
Well, you know, one thing I do every Ramzan is I make, just once a year, I make shami kebab, and I'll freeze a ton of them. And then you eat them so much that we don't want them until next year, next Ramzan. And my mom made like the best shami I've ever had. And so I have managed to like figure out how to make her shami. And shami is a little complicated. It can take a couple of days to make shami kebab. So for folks who don't know what shami kebab is, it's a mixture of, you have half lentils, which is like the chana dal we use, and then half actually boneless meat. And I always use beef. That's the classic. So you take boneless beef, you cook it with a bunch of spices, you know, all of our spices that you do until, and then you shred it and you want it nice and dry. And you boil your dal, drain it. Then you mash the dal and you mix these things together. So you have, that's kind of like your meat mixture. Everything's cooked in it, right? But what you want is the dal to be mashed and the meat to be like to have shred, like, so it's shredded. And then you add sliced onions, cilantro, green chilies, cumin, of course, cumin seeds, ginger, garlic, all the yummy stuff, and mix it together, make little patties, dip them in beaten egg and fry them. And it's like all protein. It's like a pure little protein patty. They're delicious. They do take time to make. They freeze beautifully, make a great little burger sandwich if you want. And but what my mom did that nobody else did, that this is a little secret, it's a Chaudhary family secret, nobody else did, but every time I make them, people are like, what is different in here, is that she would mince in little bits bell peppers. Minced bell pepper, add it to the mixture, it gives it a different flavor, and people are like, what is that flavor? And people can't see it, they don't know what it is, but it's there, and it's really good. Yeah, it's really good.
Yes, exclusive for the artistic foodies secret recipe.
And then when you're cooking, yeah, it, do you also dip it in the egg wash and then fry it in eggs?
Yeah. You do, you beat some eggs up and you dip it in your egg, and that's how you fry it. So I've seen people do like either breadcrumbs or like, no, the classic is that. That's the classic.
So it's encased in egg. Yeah. Okay, that sounds wonderful. And I know my wife has actually done this before, where she made a ton of shami kebabs and we'll just have it in the freezer. But then you kind of get tired of it. Gotta... So like this Ramadan, our freezer is full of dumplings that she made beforehand.
Okay, I made keema samosas. I made minced beef samosas and shami this Ramadan. So we've got those freezers full. But we eat out like every night. We're at the masjid. Like, we do iftar at the masjid almost every night. So like they almost never get eaten, but at some point we eat them.
it's perfect for the 2 a.m., you know, walking into the kitchen, what should I eat situation.
After Tarabi.
After Tarabi snack, yeah. And so just we're almost at the end of the session here, but wanted to ask about the Adnan Syed case a little bit. I know it was a big part of your life, and you know, alhamdulillah, may Allah reward you for all the work that you did to help him. So you know, at the time of this recording, there was a recent court reinstated the conviction. Are you able to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I can do it. People are very confused about what this means. They're like, does that mean he's back in prison? He's going back to prison. That's not what it means. What happened was in September of 2022, so about 6 months ago now, or I don't know how long it's been, there was a motion to vacate his conviction that was brought forth by the state itself. They're like, we want to vacate his conviction. He deserves a new trial. The conviction was vacated. At that same hearing, the victim's family filed their own motion saying, we want to postpone this because we need more time. They were in California. They said, we want to be there. The judge said, we're not going to postpone it, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to speak via Zoom. So the victim's brother spoke for like 40 minutes and the judge said, okay, now I'm going to rule on the motion to vacate his conviction. She granted it. Adnan walked out. Those are the pictures everybody saw of him walking out of the courthouse. Mm-hmm. The family, because their motion was denied, the motion to postpone the hearing was denied, appealed that denial to this appellate court that has been pending since October. I guess they appealed it like the same week. And that court just ruled that we are going to reinstate the conviction in order to do the hearing over again so the family can come and be there. Like, it is such a weird technicality. It's like never been done before in legal history. But the problem is that there can't be a conviction because then charges were actually dropped a few weeks after that, after he walked home. And so the court decided, and they literally made this up, they actually can't even do it. I don't even think it's legal for them to do this, that what we're going to do is we're going to call the charges being dropped a nullity, like it never happened. We're nullifying it. We're going to pretend the state's attorney never did that. We're going to pretend the charge, like it's never been done for a court to independently undo the actions of a state executive that they have no authority over. And it's not even like everybody's like, what is happening? Like, nobody has seen this before. Yeah. So what we're anticipating is we got to do the whole hearing over again, in which he will probably walk out the door again like he did last time. Inshallah. But this time the family gets to be there. Yeah, inshallah. Yeah. The family gets to be there. What is really weird about this ruling is that the court said the family has a right to be there, but they don't have a right to speak. So if we do this hearing again, is the family going to come from California so they can't speak? Like, I don't understand. Wow. Like, everybody loses here is how I feel. It's a really terrible, terrible legal precedent. And that's where we are. So Adnan is still out. He's, alhamdulillah, he's free. He's spending his first Ramadan home since he was 17.
Nice.
And he's working and he's doing fine. But, you know, and we have a great legal team and we're prepared. We're okay.
Great, great. Thank you very much for the update, and give our salams to Adnan and his family. And we're very happy that he's able to spend Ramadan.
Alhamdulillah, yeah. It's amazing to watch, like, just watch him in daily life, just hanging out.
Now, the only question on my mind is, what time is iftar? you know, I mean, that's why we created this podcast, is because we love talking about food and we have people on that share that same passion, you know, so.
Yeah. Wait, where are you guys? You're in California.
I'm in
where
Austin, Texas.
Okay, so yeah, I'm in DC, so we're gonna get to it before you are.
That's true. Oh, there's a lot of great people in DC. Definitely, I'm overdue for a trip. And I heard the food scene there is also pretty. The halal food scene.
I don't know. Listen, the best food scene I've seen in North America, and my husband's from Toronto, so this includes Toronto, is actually Houston.
Houston.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
That's close to
you, boss.
Yeah,
it's only 3 hours
away.
I can make it. I can make it by Maghrib. Like.
Houston beats Toronto. It beats New York. It beats New Jersey. It beats DC.
Well, what kind of food? Talking about Desi food?
Yeah. Okay, the South Asian Desi.
Just want to clarify because...
Agha's is the best Pakistani restaurant I've ever been to. And then there's an Agha's Juices, which is like blows my mind. Do you know my husband and I, we did this actually during COVID lockdown. We're like, let's just go do a weekend in Houston, just you and me eating. We just flew out for the weekend to eat in Houston, me and my husband.
Oh, nice. Yeah, my wife is from Toronto also, so I've been to Toronto plenty of times. So there's a lot.
They're pretty good too.
Got a good stuff there too. But
yeah. No, so DC doesn't really rank amongst the top. I would say, you know, DC food scenes.
I mean, I got to make sure that at least, you know, 3 to 5 good places before I travel anywhere. Otherwise, I might not come to you.
Yeah.
Oh, we can get to that many.
So you've been all over the country. So what's your favorite in the Bay Area? What's your favorite halal spot?
Okay. Honestly, I haven't been to the Bay in a very long time, but all I remember was this tiny little halal Chinese restaurant that made Szechuan food. It was tiny and family owned. In San Francisco, I don't know the name because it's been that long, probably 12 years since I went. They made this fish curry. It was like in a red sauce that I ate. And I was like, I've never eaten anything like this in my life. And literally the day we were traveling back home, I made my husband go there so I could get like 2 tubs of it. And I carried it back.
No way.
I swear, across the country. I don't know what the name of the
was
Chinese
it old, was. Was it Old Mandarin? Islamic Chinese?
Irfan, I won't even know. I don't even know. I feel like if I went there, I would know. It was this tiny little place.
That sounds a lot like Old Mandarin Islamic restaurant. They've been around for decades. Family owned, you know, really good food.
Yes. Oh, my God. Whatever. I think it was called fish, hot pot fish or something. Oh, in a red sauce. Insane. So good.
That's amazing. He's like, what's your favorite halal restaurant? You're like, this fish was amazing.
Fish. Yeah. That's kind of disqualifies.
Sorry about that.
You might as well be talking about Sog. Where's the kebabs?
Yeah.
That's true. No, but listen, the fish was silken. It was incredible.
Okay, one last question. What about Pakistan? What was your favorite place to eat? What's your favorite place to eat there?
Oh, God. Okay, so we I was just there a couple of, like a month ago. I was invited to the Karachi Literary Festival. It was amazing. So, we had a very short time. So in Lahore, really, we ate at my relatives' homes most of the time, and the food was amazing. But in Karachi, we went to a restaurant called Kolachi.
Oh, heard of that one. My God.
It's on the water. The food was mind blowing. The place was beautiful. It's huge. And it's one of the best restaurants I've been to in my life. Kolachi in Karachi.
You mean mind blast.
Mind blast. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Gotta do the wiggle.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Artistic Foodies. Before we go, show some love for your favorite podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Be sure to find us on Facebook and Instagram to stay tuned for more episodes, as well as bonus content. You can also have access to all our episodes on our website, theartisticfoodies.com.
This podcast has been brought to you by Halal Fest Incorporated and Gamma, gathering all Muslim artists.